Welcome to the Coffee Cast with Stephen Hayward of Project X. Hopefully over a good cup of coffee, we're going to have a great conversation. So please join us to welcome this week's guest on the Coffee Cast. Welcome to this week's episode of the Coffee Cast with Steve Hayward of Project X. I have with me Graham Boundy, also of Project X. Welcome, Graham.
Hello, Stephen.
Boo scary. It's our Halloween edition.
Yes, indeed. Why not? Like my costume? Oh, no, that's what I always wear.
I'm cleverly disguising myself as me. Welcome. And today's episode is going to be all about magic. And if you recall, on Friday, Graham came out with a post talking about Gartner's Magic Quadrant. So I suggest everybody hop on that post. I'll put a link into it, but as well go over to Gartner and pay the bazillions of dollars to download the Magic Quadrant, because it's been how long since 2004?
Actually, yeah, the title of the post is Waiting Since May 2004 for the newer version of the Magic Quadrants for Data Warehousing and Database Management Systems, and it was published in September of 2006 by Gartner. And much to my glee, it shows my favorite databases being in places where I want them to be.
Yeah, I think that's a great surprise, but I think there were also a couple of other really interesting surprises there that are worthy of note. I think they did a really good job, from my point of view, of capturing the essence of the positioning, because I don't know if I would disagree based on the analysis we've done over the last year on some of these things. I haven't read a great lot of detail on this because I just got a copy of this the other day, but been very interesting. So maybe, Graham, you could start off by sharing some of your surprises, because, I mean, Teradata, when we look back at 2004, had actually dropped from 2003, and all of a sudden in 2006, they're way, way up. Like, it's a big, significant move for them.
Yeah, there was certain, like, whenever I'm talking to clients about data warehousing and talking about large volumes of data, there's three vendors that I'll point to, and those three vendors are Oracle, IBM, and Teradata. And of late, conversations have drifted toward Netezza, mm-hmm. For no other reason than they have become a player in the arena. And but for the most part, we concentrate on Teradata, Oracle, and IBM. And since May 2004, it's been somewhat difficult to say to prospective clients or users of Teradata that Teradata does have a superior product and a superior ability to deliver and a superior vision of what the future of the warehousing world would be, because the May 2004 assessment clustered IBM, Oracle, and Teradata all roughly in the same area of the chart, just a little bit above all three of them in the leader category, but a little bit above halfway on the ability to execute, and all of them across the halfway mark on the visionary scale. Mm-hmm. And so because they were so close together, it was difficult to say, clearly, Teradata is the way you should go, which is always my inclination as far as the data warehousing approach goes. But now in 2006, I was very happy to see that in this diagram, you've got a nice progression of vendors that starts in that, and again, that upper right-hand quadrant, with Microsoft just being barely inside that quadrant, and then Oracle coming in next, and IBM coming in next, and Teradata coming in as the clear leader as far as being able to deliver the goods in the data warehousing world.
The funny thing is that, when we talked and we ran a process of evaluation for someone last summer, or last September, I guess it was. And when we were doing that, one of the things that we both kind of noted was that there, to a certain extent, with the evolution of DB2 and Oracle, a lot of the things that were failures of their ability to execute had kind of gone away. Now, there's still some issues, and it's anecdotal, so it's not based on any fact about the parallel systems, the grid system at DB2 and rack for Oracle, and that there we've had seen some people with some serious performance issues. But it was, the thing I found interesting was we have a very clear delineation in this list that from a visionary point of view, they're almost the same. But from an execution point of view, there is that separation. Whereas when we did that evaluation before, it almost felt like they should have been all bunched together last summer. But here we are, and they're actually a nice delineation from those.
Well, I think that the major factor in the 2004 analysis was that in many respects, Teradata was unwilling to negotiate on price. And they have since, in the last couple of years, been a little bit more willing to negotiate on price. And as a result of that, they've risen in the world in the assessment. I think the other things that have come to mind is, or something that comes to mind for me is, this is really a sliding scale from the perspective that back in 1998, when we talked about large data warehouses, we were saying, you know, Teradata set the bar at a terabyte or more, and everybody else could do things below a terabyte, but they struggled to do something above a terabyte. In the 2002-2003 time frame, that number was probably up in between the 5 and 10 terabytes, and now we see that number being upwards and above 20 terabytes and possibly getting as high as 50 terabytes before the other competitors in the other vendors in this study start to struggle, whereas Teradata is always clearly the leader, the company that's above the 50, 100 terabyte single database, one version of the truth, enterprise-wide data warehousing capability.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's certainly where it really shows its capabilities. And I guess that's also where, you know, people will then come to me and say, well, you know, so what? Not everybody has the 50 or 100 terabytes of data in their warehouse, and not everybody wants to keep that kind of volume, so why can't I just go ahead and use my Oracle or my IBM or even my SQL Server to do that?
And we've even had some conversations with people on open source. There's some good, even massively parallel processing open source SQL products out there.
Right, and I think what it comes down to, and anybody who's known me for any kind of time knows that I'm always saying performance is always an issue. And that's really what it comes to. Sooner or later, and one of the reasons that I became so enamored with Teradata way back when I started to like it was all around the fact that I could build a third normal form relational database model that would also give me the performance I needed when I started talking about large volumes of data. And when I talk about large volumes of data, I mean like millions and sometimes even billions of transactions and queries where I'm joining millions of rows against millions of rows, and I'm still getting the kind of performance that I would expect from a much smaller volume of data. And now people would argue that nowadays you can get that same kind of capability with Netezza, and I would argue against that. I think that the capability is probably there.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
But we haven't seen, I think one of the things that this study draws to that Gartner talks about, and that I've seen in a number of other analyses from different organizations, is that you can go to any one of the Teradata customers and say, are you happy with the performance of the box? Has the company Teradata been able to deliver on all of the things they promised? And the answer is always yes. and it's not always a yes for all of the other vendors.
Yeah, and that, in fairness to all those other vendors, I mean, outside of Oracle and DB2, they're all emerging. If you look at it, you know, in our conversation with Ellen Rubin that I had a couple months ago, Netezza's not been around a whole heck of a long time. So in all fairness, you got to know that with the benefits that you're getting of a lower cost and a different type of architecture and approach, you're having to deal with those differences. And the challenge I see with those situations is not any problem with the technology, but where you go and have someone that says, you know what, I'm a star schema, I'm Inman or I'm Kimball and I believe that, and then you try and shoehorn that belief system into a technology that doesn't support it. Right. And so then you end up having things fail. So it's around knowing what the right thing to actually put in place for that technology. You know, I think one of the fair things and safe bets that Netezza played was just by starting off with saying, look, we're a faster data mart solution, right, because that eliminates some of that architectural issue. But I think ultimately that's unfair to them because they're a very good repository of data. There's nothing wrong with that architecture. It's about how do you leverage it. No, I mean, you have to learn that it's done differently, right? Right. Where are the indexes?
Yeah, where are your replication? You know, recognize the fact that you're replicating data all over the place when you're building marts.
No, but if that's because they chose that as a replacement from, say, an Oracle or a DB2 as a mart solution, it's certainly very, very cost effective. I mean, you don't go and say Teradata against Netezza for a data mart, because Teradata is not really a data mart platform. You can do internal data marts and virtual versus physical and all that other lovely stuff.
Well, you could. I could argue that you could build data marts using Teradata, but that's not the way that Teradata thinks or moves. In fact, the whole concepts, the one of the things that Teradata sells a lot of is the concept of data mart consolidation. But what is data mart consolidation? Well, you pick it up as it is on whatever platform it's on. You drop it under the Teradata environment. It's still a data mart in that environment, but now you can work at integrating it into the whole. And how do you go about integrating it into the whole while you're still getting the value of the data that's coming out of the mart itself? So it's a process and approach that we've used successfully in the past, where you take the mart, you bring it into the Teradata world, where, you know, you could do the same kind of thing in a Netezza environment. You could contemplate building that third normal form enterprise-wide data warehouse, and the way to integrate those all your marts together into the single warehouse is to bring one mart at a time into that base and then integrate them together either through a normalization exercise or even just through a common key mapping capability, where you just say, okay, all the keys in this value and all the keys in this table are the same, so we can link them together and we can do our queries across those tables that way. So, you know, there's obviously a lot of dynamicness to what's happening in the data warehousing world. And I think probably the biggest thing that's going to happen, if I can project into 2007 or 2008, whenever Gartner comes out with their next one, it's going to be all around who made the transition from data warehouse to active data warehouse, and who made the transition from I'm now looking at my online transaction processing data using my analytical engine.
Yeah.
And now my OLAP world and my OLTP world, my online transaction processing world and my online analytical processing world are coming together, and we're getting to the software panacea or the data warehouse, the database panacea that we'd hoped for back in the days of COD and DATE of I have a single database. That single database represents my enterprise. I capture all of my transactional data in that database, and I report out of that same database. And migrating and merging and becoming that future, it'll be interesting to see. I think DB2 and Oracle and even SQL Server and all of the OLTP-based databases will make the transition up into the warehousing world a lot easier than Teradata will make the transition down into the OLTP world, but you're going to see that Teradata has to come down market. And I've been predicting that they needed to come down market a lot sooner than they have. In fact, I was talking about them needing to come down market in the year 2000. Now, they brought out the Windows-based Teradata engine, and Teradata supports all the referential integrity and all of the indexing and rules and so forth that our traditional RDBMS supports, relational database management system supports. But at the same time, they're not selling into that market space. They're still selling into the data warehousing space. And making the transition, I mean, think of all the applications that run on Oracle and DB2 and how difficult it would be for Teradata to get to, we can run in that same environment running an OLTP transaction engine. All we have to do is port the database function from, you know, whatever that application is, whether it's an SAP or an Amdocs or any kind of, whether that's an order management system, a billing system, or enterprise resource management system.
Or supply chain management.
Or supply chain, or any of those things. Right.
Enterprise, yeah.
Coming down market is going to be the big problem for Teradata, because right now everybody is, and we've seen it happen, you know, that thing I talked about earlier where the line goes from 1 terabyte up to 10 terabytes up to 50 terabytes, and that line keeps going up, and then the other vendors keep gobbling into Teradata's space, as it were. Teradata continues to move up, you know, into the 100 terabytes and the 250 terabytes and so on.
Supposedly they had a customer that went into petabytes the other day, so.
Good for them. So the point is, you know, Teradata is going up market, but they also have to think about how they come down market. And that's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Well, I think that's one of the things that, you know, kudos to emerging players like the Netezzas to put that challenge to them. And it's really, as you say, those down market people are really going to benefit from that pressure. And they even make note of that in this, and they give Netezza credit for keeping Teradata honest on having to lower prices to compete against that, because, you know, it's a viable option.
Absolutely.
And there's nothing that anybody can easily say when some of these things are presented. So it's very fun to see how the evolution's happening. One of the things I just wanted to mention was they actually made some good references to, you know, the way that these sort of data warehouses are being used and the workloads, and they actually did a nice job of explaining that. So I'm going to riff on a little bit of that. But to your point about active, so they talked about continuous real-time data loading and almost real-time, because the definition of what real-time means for people is very different. And that talks to your OLTP observation. And I really, that's really key in the evolution. You know, just now you've got users in the thousands. So the way they're leveraging their reporting structures and how they're doing that, you know, it's thousands per day. I mean, I was talking to a client the other day, they've got like 30,000 ETL loads going in and out of things. Right? Like, that's just incredible in terms of the amount of interaction with that database. And that's just the loading side and the unloading for downstream applications, let alone the, I mean, I think they might have mentioned something like 50,000 reports. Probably only about 1,000 of those are actually being used, but you know.
Where's the metadata solution to manage all that?
And then they talk about just the ad hoc use of it, and now that with all the tools that people have and, you know, the MicroStrategies and the SASs and all these other folks that have really given lots of power to that end business user to be able to do it. I thought that was good. You know, it's really changing the game. The fourth one really I thought that they gave was kind of a fourth workload, and saying increasing level of analytics and BI-oriented functionality in our online transaction processing. But I looked at that as just as much around the ad hoc query and the large number of reports. But maybe for them and for the way they've been able to evolve, they're looking at it. It's a worthwhile separation, but very interesting. But I was really interested to see it. I was surprised to see Microsoft move into the Visionaries box.
Well, yeah, I wasn't so much surprised by that. I thought that they didn't gain any ground. Microsoft didn't gain any ground from an execution perspective, ability to execute perspective, which I found interesting. Whereas Sybase seemed to make huge gains in the ability to execute, but didn't make too much gain in the visionary scale of things. So,
which is pretty good in that I think some people thought they were going to go away.
Uh-huh.
So even being able to just continue existing mm-hmm. was a nice thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
now, I guess the other thing that's interesting about this is, you know, you don't see any of the old. In fact, you didn't see it in 2004 either. The data mart worlds, like the red bricks of the world and so forth.
That they didn't make it into the last one either.
Just disappeared into. I mean, they're still out there, but are slowly being migrated off that platform, most likely to Oracle and or DB2.
And I was really disappointed. They made mention at the beginning of Sun stepping in with that Green Plum MPP, the Massively Parallel Processing open source database, and then they didn't talk about it. They didn't talk about that being as a viable solution. And I, you know, maybe it's just still a little too early. But there's a whole spot here for visionaries, and you know, maybe they just couldn't evaluate whether it was even implementable. But so very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Before we jump on to the next topic, any other comments?
Well, I guess the only other thing to say is, you know, there is a little bit of excitement right now around data warehousing in the market, I think. And I think that comes from, we've gotten over the whole networking problem before the year 2000. We got over the year 2000 problem. And then when the bubble burst in 2001, everybody kind of thought, well, okay, now what's next? And I think people are starting to realize that as boring as data is, it's got to get exciting, because there's a lot of it out there, and managing it and taking care of it is a real challenge.
Well, I think as with a lot of other core enterprise applications, you know, the Sarbanes-Oxley's of the world, and all these calls for reporting and process have really poked holes in, you know, other ways of dealing with it. But, you know, the other comment I have about all of this stuff, and I think it should be treated as a grain of salt, in that it is an analyst report, and I'm not meaning to degrade the value of it, because I do think and see value in it. But at the end of the day, you've got to figure out what actually maps to your requirements, because this chart is only valuable as much as it relates to who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember, I can't remember if it was Gartner or Forrester, one of the two, saying that we were going to be paperless by 95 or 1990 or some crazy thing. And having seen how much paper flows around the world, there's no chance that that's going to happen in the short term.
Well, we just missed it by a couple of years. I mean, you look at George Orwell's 1984, right? I mean, it was written in years before 1984. And when you hit 1984, you thought, okay, well, this is it. Well, here we are in 2006, and I think in 2004 I was thinking there was a lot of Big Brother and 1984 type stuff happening. So maybe we just missed it by a few years. Gartner, paperless office will come sometime in the future. And all of our predictions of the future are obviously restricted and or adjusted by the realities of how quickly people are willing to change, and events that we just don't perceive or couldn't perceive.
So the last one, and I'll make it short because we're at 24 minutes here, but I just came back from my little event down in Connecticut at Robert H. Schaefer and Associates, and it was a blast.
Well, good.
Yeah.
So what did you learn?
What did I learn? Well, we were talking about high-impact consulting, which was kind of neat. So I learned a little bit about some of the nuances of consulting, and certainly the type of consulting that they were generally helping people deal with was large change management organizational type stuff, and that was way outside the box for me in that we're largely a technology-oriented organization. But the first comment was in the first day, for most general working session type conversations, I was completely lost because of the fact that the business had all of their own acronyms.
Oh,
I lived the other side of the coin.
Right.
And I remember at a break going, what does OD stand for? What does the little, and I would try and ask and the thing, but try not to disrupt the flow. And it was so obvious to everybody that it was organizational development or, you know, any number of other acronyms and short forms that these folks could use. It was really a good opportunity to see the other side of that issue. And it was good, but they talked about everything from consultant to anxiety and what that does as you try and work on crafting out solutions for clients and how that changes your behavior into a not productive manner. The first day was really good. It laid some groundwork, some common dialogue, and kind of got us working together. The second day was really the most important for me, I mean, as to why I was there, which was to talk about rapid results and what the nature of that was and how you do rapid results projects. And then they went into the workout process, which I kept on calling breakout because I was taking breakthrough and putting it in, but it is workout, which is a process that one of the founders of, or sorry, one of the senior consultants at RHSA actually was involved in the original team that built it with GE, and they've just run a ton of those, and they're very similar in feel to the rapid results, so you can kind of get lots of good learning from the two, but they are very distinctly different. And the workout is a, you know, a 1 month preparation to this 2 day very large team event where you're then having it break out into these subgroups, and there's a nice process to the whole structure. But it's really for big, large, diverse groups where you're going to end up having multiple streams of suggested activities to line up to that overall objective. Really interesting, and I was thinking a lot about it when you're starting to talk about linking strategy and so forth to technology and how you could go about doing that, and with larger groups, if you could invite your customers, say in the enterprise data warehouse world, to be able to have this 2 day session and coming up with, here's the things that we think we should do, and you know, some rules around. Very interesting. I'm not sure it perfectly relates, but it certainly gave me a lot of food for thought. Rapid result was exactly what I thought it was. It was as straightforward, as simple. It takes a lot of work and a lot of creative thinking, and certainly the role of the facilitator slash consultant in that role isn't as straightforward as you might think. And there's a lot of challenge in terms of building consensus and managing the meetings and being able to change the flow of how you're getting to some things. But really enjoyed the fact that, and I even used it today in a meeting, where you work on setting the objective and taking it to down to a certain level of clarity to the end customer or the group, sorry, the group that you're with, but you leave the how we're going to do it and what that is to the group. And you try not to put too many rules, unless there are rules and guidelines and things like that, out, because it leaves room for open thought. And there's a tennis ball exercise that they gave us, which was a perfect example of, if you give certain rules, the open opportunity to how people will go and solve the problem and then give them guidance. But if you go and tell them, then there's not the ownership of that. You can maybe have a bunch of ideas and thoughts around where it can go, but the purpose is that the greater team can generally figure it out. So today in my meeting, we did this exact same exercise, and it was just a 4-hour kickoff meeting, a scope kind of meeting. And, you know, we aligned everybody. I was really pleased to see, you know, our power client aligned the team to the objectives and set out some stuff. We had it very well articulated, and he did an amazing job. And then the team just went at it, and it was really fun to watch them go. And they came up with some stuff that shaved. I mean, we're trying to take a what should be a 16-week engagement and shoehorn it into about 5. And they pulled 4 weeks out of it just in the matter of 5 minutes. And then they pulled another 3 weeks out of it by being able to be open to another way of creating the platform. So it was really interesting to see. And I thought there was lots of value in that. And there was a lot of introspection that will break down you and I over the next little bit. And maybe we'll learn some lessons out of it. But it was just amazing. If you can go on it, go. If you can, try and get lots of people that you want to have alignment of that thinking, because it's going to probably suck to come back into an environment where no one else wants to be and think that way, and you're trying to go rah, 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 and they're going, whoa, hold
the
horse.
The risk of being the voice crying in the wilderness, right?
Yeah, so the great opportunity for us with this client is that they are very much about, you know, how do I embrace this change faster and do it, because they can't live the way that all things were. And in a lot of cases, they just don't have the time to do those things. Mm-hmm. So it was really good. I'm going I've got about 30 pages of notes that I took, and I will try and distill some of my personal observations either in posts going forward over the next couple of weeks. But it was really good. Cool. So thanks for letting me go, Graham.
Hey, no worries.
And thanks to Wes and Katie for putting on an absolutely great and mesmerizing show. It was really fun to see the two of them, how they operated and the energy that they could maintain, especially after lunch, because they served some good lunches.
So that's the real reason to go. I should go for the good lunches?
Go for the good lunches. No, you're already set up to go for when the sailing's good. So.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Good lunches and sailing. Okay, you've sold me. I'm there.
You had me at hello. Anyway, thanks, and everybody safe Halloween. And remember, please be careful. There'll be lots of little kidlets running around, not necessarily paying attention to proper traffic and all that stuff, of which... Mm. My little 3.5-year-old son might be one of them, and we want everybody to come home safe. So, thanks, Graham.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right.
Good.
For more information about Project X, please join us on our website at www.pxltd.ca, or hop on our blog and join in the conversation at pxltd.typepad.com. This is a copyright of Project X Limited. Thank you for joining us today.